Thank you. So we have a special, very special guest for you tonight for Satsang. As you know, since I finished How to Know God, we put up a How to Know God website, and there's been a lot of conversation on the How to Know God. And over the last 5-6 years, I have been very personally interested in the history of Christianity and how it comes about that here we are in the United States, where a lot of people actually think that Christ was a blue-eyed blonde born in Manhattan and don't recognize that he was in many ways an Asiatic. He was Jewish, he spoke in Aramaic, and the original languages of biblical times were Aramaic and Babylonian and Hebrew and ancient Hebrew, and that there were a lot of other teachings which now we are getting familiar with as with the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which you'll hear about in a few minutes, and so many interesting texts which now are being called the Gnostic Gospels, the Gospel according to Thomas, the Gospel according to Mary, the Gospel according to Peter, so many other texts that were actually consciously taken out from Christianity. When in the 4th century, King Constantine had his council in what is now Istanbul or Constantinople, and actually edited out a lot of the texts that were very much like the knowledge that we have been discussing in the last few days, Vedic knowledge. In fact, there's a whole school of thought that suggests, and you might clarify this if maybe I'm wrong, but there's a school of thought that suggests that Thomas, Doubting Thomas, was actually Indian, that he might have been one of the teachers of Jesus Christ. In any case, I've been myself very interested in this area. I've been doing a lot of research. And in the last week or so, I posted my little historical research on the origins of that famous line that most fundamentalists like to quote from John, where he says, I am the light, I am the way, I am the life, and no one comes unto the Lord except through me. And if you actually go through the original Aramaic, it actually means something quite different from what it seems to come through the King James Version. And in the Aramaic, he's talking about the spirit, he's talking about prana, he's talking about unity consciousness. He's talking about the concepts that you and I have been discussing all this week, that we've all been talking about, how intention in the field of infinite possibilities starts to weave a series or continuum of space-time events that go on into eternity. What David was talking about this morning about the karmic hallways. There's nothing in the original literature that's at all unfamiliar to those who have looked at the perennial philosophies of the world. So it's kind of disconcerting that, you know, you have such profound knowledge that gets so totally edited out in the 4th century. It has absolutely no resemblance to the original texts. Remember that the original texts were first not texts. They were oral transmissions in Aramaic and Hebrew, and then in Greek, and then in Latin, and finally around the 14th century in English. And the first New Testament version to appear in the United States was only 1881. And even that version had a lot edited out, even from the King James Version. And I was telling my friend Bob Thurman, who's a professor of comparative religion in Columbia University, and he happened to quote some of this material to one of his audiences, and a young woman came up to me and she said, if the King James Version was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for me. Okay. So, anyway, enough about that. Today we have an expert with us, somebody who's actually research the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it is my really great privilege to welcome both Greg and his wife Melissa. And let me tell you a little bit about Greg. Greg Braden, he's actually a scientist. He's an earth scientist. He is an aerospace software engineer. He has a good, great background in some of the topics that we've been discussing, quantum physics. He's a scientist who's made a lot of really interesting discoveries and is continuing to do work with the Dead Sea Scrolls. And he is giving us this very profound insight about what happened 1700 years ago when key elements of what is now known as the Western ancient heritage were lost, relegated to the esoteric traditions of mystery schools and sacred orders. And among the most empowering of the forgotten elements are references to a science with the power to bring everlasting healing to our bodies and initiate an unprecedented era of peace and cooperation between governments and nations. And what he's talking about is in this book called The Isaiah Effect, which is available to you here in our bookstore, Decoding the Lost Science of Prayer and Prophecy. In many ways, what he's talking about is actually what you've been doing, sutra practice, shifting your consciousness and radiating such a state of awareness that it creates effects in the environment. And we've been talking about non-local effects, the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen equation, the fact that consciousness is a field of infinite possibilities, and when you cause a slight perturbation in that field, it ripples across the cosmos. And it's not confined to your physical body, because at quantum mechanical levels, your body has no well-defined edges. It's a wiggle in the unified field. And when there's a coherent collective intent, as we're doing here, then the changes are very profound. And there's good research to support this. Demographic research, research on crime rates, hospital admissions, violence, and even biochemical effects. I was involved many years ago in a research where we had 7,000 people meditating together. And one of the effects of collective meditation is that your serotonin levels go up. And there's a metabolite of serotonin called 5-hydroxyindoleacetic acid, which is found in the urine, which significantly goes up in people when they're meditating together. So we were doing this study where 7,000 people were meditating together. And of course, their serotonin levels went up. But what was surprising is, if you went out on the street and just picked up anyone on the street and took their urine sample, even their serotonin levels had gone up, even though they were unaware of what was happening. And today we know the effects of prayer in patients with cardiovascular disease and so on. And what Greg Braden is telling us, is that this knowledge was also part of the teachings of the Judeo-Christian traditions. And had it not been for the editing that took place about 1700 years ago, we would see that actually all these great religions are part of the perennial philosophies of humanity. So it's a great privilege and a great honor to have you and Melissa here with us this evening and to grace us. Please welcome Greg.
Well, first, that is the best description of my book that I've ever heard, and it really sums up my work. And actually, I'd like to thank Deepak for the first 20 minutes of my program. He's made very easy now, because that was essentially what I was going to say, so we can just skip right. No, it works perfectly. I'm going to start by saying good evening, and thank you to so many people. I'd like to say thank you to Deepak Chopra for inviting us to be here this evening and acknowledging what I know is a tremendous act of trust in inviting another speaker to come in the middle of a program. We met for the first time at dinner this evening, although we know each other by our work, and the truth is he really doesn't know what I'm going to say tonight. So it is a tremendous act of trust, and thank you very much. I appreciate you. Another example of how this man is pioneering new forums and new thought and new ways of looking at our world and our lives together, and I certainly acknowledge that. Thank you. And to all the people at the Chopra Center who have made this possible, and my wife Melissa for traveling. We've been on the road for about 5 weeks with a book tour. We haven't been home since last October, and I told her just two more programs, I promise, and we're on our way home. And to the Ford agency and the Ford group and all the people there who have made it possible for me to be here this evening. So, and to all of you who invited me into your presence here, I have to ask the question, who has absolutely no idea who I am or what I'm going to talk about tonight? Oh, well, thank you for your honesty. Who is too shy to raise your hand and tell me you have no idea? Raise your hand. That's fine. So I'll thank you for your trust then in coming to a program you know absolutely nothing about and committing to an evening. I'm going to begin with a story to bring us into the material that we'll address this evening. And this is a story, this is a true story. It's a story of 9 children. It came to me as I was writing the last phases of the book, The Isaiah Effect. 9 children who were involved in a program called the Special Olympics. And for those of you that may not be familiar with Special Olympics, it was designed for children so they may compete and participate in athletic competition in the presence of what some people perceive as disabilities that prevent them from participating in normally scheduled events. These 9 children came together. They quickly became friends, and they dined together, they slept together, they practiced and trained for these events together, and one day they found themselves competing against one another in the same event. And they were at the starting line of this event, and the starting gun went off, and under whatever means of locomotion they had, they began moving toward the end of this track. And there was one boy, one very special boy with Down syndrome. If you've ever been around any Down children, you know how powerful they are. And it was this boy who took just a moment, and rather than focusing on winning the race, he stopped in the middle of the track, and he turned around to look where his other teammates, his friends, were at. And what he saw was that one of his friends had not even made it off of the starting line, that he had fallen at the very beginning. And this boy turned around, he began walking back to that starting line, and as if it was on an unspoken cue, one by one, each of the other children stopped in the middle of their race, and they turned around, and they walked back to the starting line. And they each knelt down, and they picked up their friend, and they held him by his arms, and they locked their elbows together. And together, they began to walk to the end of this track, because they said it made no difference for one of them to be there unless they were all there together. And that's a powerful story. Powerful story. Okay, can you feel that feeling that just moved through the audience? Did you feel it? I'm feeling it right now. What does it feel like? What do you feel? What did you feel in your body? I felt there's a wave. It just went just like this. If I had come into this room and said to you, have that feeling, could you have done it? Perhaps, maybe not. We are conditioned in our world to have our feelings in response to something else that happens to us in our world. What I'm going to say to you is that feeling is the reason that we're here this evening, perhaps this entire week. That feeling is a doorway to a power that lives within each of us, and it's a power that we know intuitively that our logic began to forget about 1,700 years ago. Now I'm going to ask you another survey question. Do you believe that there is a power that lives within us that can heal our bodies, not impose a temporary healing, but heal our bodies, bring a lasting peace to our world, to the governments and nations of our world? I'm not finished yet. And perhaps avert the greatest tragedies ever to face humankind. Do you believe that kind of power lives within us? Yes. And don't say yes just because you're in the seduction of spirit. I believe we have that power as well, and I believe that the information is out there. Our own science now has demonstrated through very good research that this power exists. I believe we need more information, more research, and we know enough now to perhaps move beyond the investigation to applying this power, to bring it to bear in our lives upon what are perhaps the greatest challenges ever to face humankind. The end of the 20th century, doesn't it feel great to say that? The end of the 20th century, some of the best minds, the best scientists and researchers in our world said to us that within the next 10 to 12 years, humankind may expect perhaps the greatest challenges ever recorded in our history. And they also said there's a good possibility that our external technology, the machines that we have built around us, will fail us in these challenges. And perhaps that is what it takes. I believe it does not take that, because we have an inner technology that we remember, that we know, that we're striving to breathe life into in the presence of one another, this inner technology, this power. Almost universally, ancient texts, ancient traditions remind us, as we go back far enough in history, that there is a wisdom that was given to the people of this earth from the moment that the first man and the first woman walked this earth and raised their eyes to the heavens. There is a wisdom that has lived among us. And I believe we know that, we feel that. Where's that wisdom now? What happened to that wisdom? If such a power does exist, this inner technology, where is it today? Is it possible that something happened somewhere in our history that perhaps has left a gap in what we know, in the way we view our world, in the way we view our relationship to the cosmos, to this earth, and to one another, maybe even the way we love? Well, the answer to that is yes, and I'm going to do this very briefly because Deepak did such a wonderful job sharing this with us tonight. What we know is that 1,700 years ago, tremendous amounts of information were taken from the open literature where we had always gone to know of these relationships. This information was edited from our most sacred texts. We knew it in our hearts, in our minds. We chose to reference this in the texts. When those texts were removed, there was no biblical text at this time. 1,700 years ago, there wasn't a Bible as we know it today. There was a loose collection, an assemblage of scrolls and documents and manuscripts, oral transmissions that had accumulated over tremendous amounts of time. When this information was edited, what was left was further reduced and simplified, and the information was rearranged. They say, the Roman texts say, so that it would make sense to the average person on the street, so that it would become accessible to us. We know, for example, at least 25 books were taken from what later became our Western Bible. Ladies, if you ever wonder why we don't hear more about women in the Bible, Mary, the birth of Mary, there's an entire gospel of the birth of Mary that tells us about her mother. Her mother was 81 years old when she gave birth to Mary and been barren all of her life. Mary was 14 years old when she was betrothed to Joseph. There are no missing years of Jesus. Really, they're missing because they were taken out of the texts. And they are powerful texts because, for example, this text, the infancy of Jesus, tells the story of a young man coming into this world just the way that we have, with powers that he is struggling to understand and how he comes to know those powers in his lifetime. This is just a sample of some of this information. These 25 books were taken from the text, an additional 20 supporting documents. So we're talking about 45 texts that disappeared 1,700 years ago. What happened before the beginning, the first and the second books of Adam and Eve? One of the most powerful technological books I've ever seen, The Secrets of the Prophet Enoch, speaking to us of the luminaries, with information so accurate it could not even be confirmed until the 20th century. Today, many of our scientific principles, our spiritual properties, spiritual principles, practices, historic beliefs, I'm not saying they're wrong, and I believe we've done the best we could do with what we have. What I am saying is there's a very good possibility they're incomplete. Our science is good. The scientific method is good. However, we apply the scientific method where we believe there's a reason to use it. When these texts were lost, scientists found no reason to investigate a relationship between what happens in here and what happens out there. And that's changing now very quickly. This is the generation where that changes. There is one key that I believe above all other keys is so powerful. Those texts, many of them were written by a group called the Ancient Essenes, and we're going to talk a lot about the Essenes tonight. The key that the Essenes left for us says this. It says simply that the world around us is a mirror of the beliefs that we harbor from within. They suggest that our world out there, although it looks solid, it looks tangible, that it is actually soft and malleable, like sculptor's clay. And instead of the hands of a sculptor that mold our external world, it is our consciousness. Quantum science now, in just the last 3 years, has made discoveries under laboratory conditions that are lending tremendous credence to this. This tenet, if the world out there mirrors what we are in here, it says the chaos of our changing world, the violence in our communities. People are saying, where's this violence come from? The violence in our communities, the unsettled weather patterns of nature are seen as mirrors of collective anger, rage, jealous competition, and hate that we harbor from within, on the one hand. The flip side of that, if this tenet holds true, the same view suggests that as we heal the personal challenges of our inner lives, and I know that's what these programs are all about, as we heal our inner challenges through forgiveness, understanding, tolerance, and compassion, that we may full well expect our outer world to mirror that to us as subtle patterns and gentle change. Do you believe in that? Do you believe there's any relationship whatsoever between the events unfolding in our world and what's happening in our body? Do you? You know that within the last 2 years, I could not have said this until the last 2 years, Western science, now I have to preface this, I was born and raised in a very conservative Midwestern community with no specific religious training, and my background in the academics and the hard sciences does not prepare me for what I'm about to share with you, because it makes no allowances for these relationships. Our own science now is finding a direct relationship between weather patterns and mass emotion in large population centers. Emotion is magnetic in nature. Barometric pressure responds to human emotion, to mass magnetics. The ancients have said that for a long time. We didn't understand what they were saying. We may have perhaps the single most powerful force. We may harbor that within us because what will become from within is determining, from this perspective, to a large degree, what we see in the world around us. Well, in some places, unlikely, as these caves that are actually found 1,300 feet below sea level in an area known as Qumran, along the shores of the Dead Sea, the series of caves that we find along those shores, something happened in 1946 that forever changed the way we view our world. In that day, two Bedouin boys, they were sheep herders, did something they had done many times in the past. They were herding their sheep along those caves, and they threw stones into one of the openings. Only this time, something happened that never happened before. They heard something break and shatter inside. And what they had heard was their stones striking a series of clay vases that had been sealed for almost 2,000 years. And inside these vases, sealed with straw and tar resin, they began to find scrolls. Scrolls of information that was recorded and hidden for safekeeping before the edits of the 4th century. Scrolls that had the texts, many that we had never seen before until we discovered these caves in 1946. By the way, they were reported to the world in 1947, and that's why many people believe 47 is the year of the discovery. Some of the scrolls were written, such as the ones you're seeing now, they were written on copper that was pounded so thin it became brittle over time. New technologies had to be developed so that we could even open and read these scrolls. And what they say to us today, in some respects, we have never seen with our eyes, although we felt in our hearts. Many of the scrolls were written in papyrus, the paper from that part of the world, made from a plant, much as you see in Egypt today. Some of the scrolls were written on animal hide, lamb skin. They were written in the languages, the ancient languages of Hebrew, Aramaic, the language of Jesus, as well as Greek. Some of these scrolls were no more than fragments, maybe an inch square. And when I began studying these, I asked myself, why don't we hear more about these? How many scrolls could there be? And what I discovered was that between 1946 and 1959, 11 caves were found with over 25,000 fragments of paper, papyrus, copper, and animal hide that comprised approximately 800 scrolls. And all of that information was given to a team of only 7 scholars. And they were all male. 7 male scholars. And as they began, if you can imagine, translating, compiling, editing, and preparing this information to be released, what was happening within them as they saw what it was that they had found. Perhaps one of the most interesting is the original book of Genesis. There was only one copy of this scroll found anywhere in these caves. For the first time, we saw the unedited version of the original book of Genesis. And the story goes on and on. It is through these scrolls that we find a tremendous amount of information about the background of the people that had recorded them, the ancient Essenes. The Essenes hold a lineage of wisdom that now is traced back over 4,000 years before Christ, 6,000 years ago. And what I'm sharing with you tonight, I could have done in many traditions. We could have done this in Buddhist traditions or Vedic traditions, Native North American, Native South American, Egyptian, Mayan. I'm sharing these traditions because in the West, these are the ones that we're looking to. And in their completeness, we may see something. The ancient Essenes wrote to a people they could only imagine in their dreams, in the only language that they knew. They wrote to us, sharing this wisdom. Through the insights left by the Essenes, we are just beginning to recognize 2 very powerful technologies. And I use that word intentionally because these are technologies that allow us to determine the condition of our bodies, number one, and number two, the future of our world, because the Essenes say what's happening in here is mirrored out there. The first is a technology of prophecy. And by the way, for those of you who might find the word prophecy too new age or new thought-ish, prophecy is taken very seriously in our world today. Our scientists and researchers have given it a new name. They call it remote viewing. It's the ability to project our awareness through time, our senses, and to peer into distant future, past, or other possibilities in the present moment and record what is happening. So the first technology is prophecy. It allows us to witness future consequences of choices that we make in the present. If we do this and this now, how does it affect our world 1,000 years from now? The second is a technology of prayer, and I'm going to say this right now, a lost mode of prayer that is very different than any prayer we've seen in the West in a traditional sense. A mode of prayer that has no words. There are no words to this prayer. It has no outward expression. It is a consciousness that we achieve within as an inner technology. And I believe this is what Deepak is talking about, although we've never had this conversation. The second is a technology of prayer allows us to choose which of the future prophecies we live. Future prophecies happen for individuals. You have prophecy for the next day of your life, and the next 10 years of your life, as well as our collective prophecies in terms of what will happen in our world. Quantum physics may be defined, of the many ways it may be defined, as the study of non-physical forces whose movements touch and create our physical world. That feeling that moved through this room, if you're listening to this on tape, when I shared the story, that feeling that moved through your body, that is a non-physical force, and we know it has an effect on our physical world. Well, in Jerusalem today, the place called the Shrine of the Book Museum, the first 7 scrolls from that first cave are displayed, and they're displayed in a way, it is fascinating, it is unique. In the center of the Shrine of the Book Museum is a vertical cylinder, and upon this vertical cylinder, one scroll is completely unfolded and displayed. It wraps around the cylinder so it may be read today. This scroll is believed to be so precious that this entire cylinder will retract into the floor of the museum, into a concrete and steel reinforced vault with steel doors that close over the top in the event of a nuclear attack, so that above all others, this scroll may be held for future generations. It is the great Isaiah scroll of the prophet Isaiah, the only scroll that was found completely intact. And all the Dead Sea Scrolls, 66 books, are recorded, 66 chapters in the Isaiah scroll. The Isaiah scroll says something to us in a completeness. Now, clearly, this is not the only place to find this information. But for Westerners, and for the way that we view information, I've chosen this as a template. As we understand what Isaiah was saying, we understand many, many other traditions and many other texts. The completeness of Isaiah allows us to do precisely this, to see as a template, to explore the mysteries of prophecy in prayer. And one of the ways that we do that is by understanding the physics of time. The ancients looked at time very differently than we do today. Many of them say that our relationship to time is the secret to the healing in our bodies. It's the secret to transcending, not just surviving, but to transcend the great challenges of our time, how we relate to time. Many ancient traditions have records of time, such as the zodiac calendar in the temple ceiling of Dendera in Egypt. This is the first place that we see all of the zodiac, the signs of the zodiac, for those of you that study astrology. And I'm sharing this as an example of one way that we record time as it passes by us. And that's one way of viewing time. Many ancient traditions, including the Egyptians, also viewed time essentially as a medium. And rather than passing us by, they suggest that we may travel through time. That we can travel through time. We were just in Egypt in November, December of 99. And there's a temple that has been discovered about 90 miles outside of Luxor on the west bank of the Nile. This temple is unlike any other temple we've ever seen in Egypt. It is dedicated solely to the study of time. A temple dedicated to time. And through the language, through the hieroglyphs so deeply and clearly incised upon this site, what we are able to determine is that this understanding in this temple, this particular understanding of time, lends new credence to quantum physics, quantum science, and the idea of prophecy in ways that we're just beginning to understand. Albert Einstein, a man who I admire and just respect tremendously, I read him when I was a child, even before I understood what I was reading, said to us about time. He said, time is not at all what it seems. It does not flow in only one direction, and the future exists simultaneously with the past in the same moment. Einstein says that to us. Stephen Hawking, in recent times, now takes that one step further. He says that quantum mechanics does not predict a single definite result for an observation. We don't know precisely what's going to happen in the future. Rather, it predicts a number of different futures, possible outcomes, and tells us how likely each of these is. When I was in school, I was taught that time moves in two directions, forward and reverse, our future and our past. Our science today now allows for time to move in three directions, past, future, and something that we call vertical time. Vertical time. What vertical time suggests is that in any moment of time, many, many, many experiences are all playing out at the same moment. The key is they're already created. How many of you have heard it said that we create our reality? I've heard that. Quantum science now suggests that that is close. It may be more accurate, however, to say rather than creating our reality, if they are already created, that we choose which of the many possibilities already created we bring to bear in our lives. It says that on a personal level, for every moment of personal challenge, if we're diagnosed with a potentially life-threatening condition, that there are other possibilities where that simply doesn't exist. You're going to see one of those on video tonight before we leave here. It says on a global level, If we're facing the possibility of a global war, a global Holocaust, there are other possibilities where that never happened. The question is, how do we move from one to another? These ideas are called parallel possibilities, and they were first proposed, that I'm aware of, in modern times in 1957 at Princeton University by a gentleman named Dr. Hugh Everett III. And in his theory, Hugh Everett says, not only are there many possibilities, every once in a while, we reach a place where we can jump, where we can leap from one possibility to another. He called those choice points. Choice points. What he says is this, that we can start our day or our millennium in one range of possibilities, and through choices that we make, through a technology that lives within us, individually, collectively, we can come together and create a zone wherein we may leap to other possibilities. Just because it looks like we're going to have a global war, we don't have to have one. Just because it looks like we have a life-threatening condition doesn't mean that we have to carry that condition to its fullest extent. 2,500-year-old scrolls say precisely the same thing in a language that we're just beginning to understand. Prophet Isaiah was considered to be the first of the major Old Testament prophets. And I'm going to share with you just a little bit of what Isaiah says about our future, and I'm going to do it in a way that provides an example for many prophecies. You've all heard of Edgar Cayce, Nostradamus, many of the ancient indigenous prophecies, Hopi, and things like that. I'm going to share something from Isaiah through what he calls his apocalypse. When you hear the word apocalypse, it sounds frightening, doesn't it? Do you know that that word only means, the Greek for apocalypse is apocalypsis, and all it means is to disclose or reveal. And that's it. So what Isaiah is saying to us, I'm going to disclose or reveal to you what I have remote viewed or seen in your future. He said he sees a time where the earth is utterly laid waste, utterly stripped, where the earth is polluted because of its inhabitants who have transgressed laws, violated statutes, and broken the ancient covenant. He sees a time where the cities, nothing remains but ruin, foundations of the earth shake, where the moon will blush and the sun will grow pale. You've heard these things before. Now here's the part that makes scholars crazy. Because in the same moment of time, Isaiah sees something else. He sees a time where streams burst forth in the desert, where the burning sands become pools of water in the thirsty ground. Sorrow and mourning leaves the people of the earth. He sees a time where the parched land gives water and flowers, and where the eyes of the blind will be opened and the ears of the deaf will be cleared. Very, very different from the frightening vision. Scholars say, which is it? Is it the catastrophic destruction, or is it this time of peace, healing, and joy? We're asking the question, could the prophecies now be showing us a range of possibilities rather than a sequence of events? The traditional interpretation is that we have to go through the bad times to get through the good times, personally as well as collectively, that we have to go through what Native Americans sometimes call the purification before we come to the healing. Or many biblical traditions say is the tribulation before the times of peace. Well, is this what we're being shown? Do we have to go through the bad times to get to the good times? Or could the prophets have been showing us something we're just beginning to understand? Could they have been standing in what the ancients called the rivers of time, or the roads, or the paths, or the waves, or the ribbons of time? Rather than looking at a series, a sequence of events, maybe they were looking at an array of possibilities that range from the darkest of the dark to the lightest of the light. Does that make sense so far? A range of possibilities. If this is true, in the only language of their time, the ancients may have been saying something very, very different. All prophecies may be saying something very different. What Isaiah is saying of the many things, and please, this is so brief and so high level, we are just barely scratching the surface of what I believe these texts are saying to us, and many other traditions are saying the same things. That we have, first of all, the ability to know, to glimpse into future consequences of choices that we make in the present. Secondly, we embody the power to choose which of those consequences we experience. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about that kind of power? Well, thank you. For some people, this is frightening, because for some people, that degree of power is overwhelming to them. They say, my God. And that's exactly right. My God. The question is, do we know how to choose? I believe we know precisely how to choose. What the Roman texts say to us is that when the Essenes disbanded in the first century after the crucifixion, they took these libraries with them. They hid the scrolls in the Dead Sea, above the caves of Qumran, and they were scattered across the face of the earth. And everywhere they went, they took their libraries with them. My reasoning in the spring of 1998, I said, if we were ever to find any of these texts, we will probably find the most intact texts in the place that has been least disturbed by modern civilization. And at that time, it was the highlands of today what we call central Tibet. In March of 98, I had the honor and the privilege of facilitating a 22-day pilgrimage into 12 monasteries and 2 nunneries in some of the most awesome, desolate, magnificent, beautiful, and frightening land that I've ever seen in my life. What we know is that the Tibetans are master record keepers. In addition to the Buddhist traditions of today and their native Bon, B-O-N, traditions that were their practice before the Buddhist traditions, the Tibetans also have pre-Christian and Christian records in their monasteries that came with the Essenes, the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls, when they fled Qumran. And by the way, as a little aside, the records show that these same libraries traveled into Peru, into Bolivia, and into the American desert southwest. And the Native Americans today have traditions of actually working with the Essenes, the Hopi and the Navajo and the Lakota Sioux, to understand what these traditions are saying about our relationship to the earth and one another. We journeyed to places over 17,500 feet above sea level. And it is so beautiful there. In those elevations, nothing lives. There's no grass, no vegetation, no algae in the water. There's the sky and the earth and you and God. And I believe this may be why perhaps so many revelations come to us at these high elevations, because the diversions are absent. All that's there is us. We met the most amazing people. We met a woman that walked out of a yak-haired tent at 15,000 feet above sea level, and she said through the translators, she asked us, she says, do you know how precious this time in our history is? Do you know about the great change? Because in her traditions, the Kali Yuga is very close to an end, and what happens after that, we're creating right now. She knows this. Our traditions, Western traditions, when I say ours, in many instances, have forgotten these traditions. We met with some of the most beautiful nuns in the nunneries, monks in the monasteries, each preserving a lineage of wisdom. And in each case, we asked a question time and time again. And it was very near the end of the journey at one particular monastery, I asked the question that's the crux of what we're doing here this evening. Is this one particular monastery, we had the opportunity to meet with the abbot of this monastery, and I asked him this question. I said, when we sit among you in the chanting halls, and we hear your prayers, we hear your toning in your ohms, in your ohms, in your ooms, in your mantras, in your mudras, in your chimes, and bells, and bowls, and gongs, in the incense for 14 and 18 hours a day, on the outside, I said, what happens to you on the inside? This is something you can't get from an ancient text. What happens to you on the inside? And this abbot smiled. He didn't really laugh at me, but he kind of chuckled. Maybe he laughed at me a little bit. Kind of like that. He smiled and he said, you've never seen our prayers, because a prayer cannot be seen. He said, what you have seen is what we do to create the feeling in our bodies. And the feeling is the prayer. Then he turned it around on me as the leader of our group. He said, how do you do it in your culture? And what I began to understand was that when we lost those texts 1,700 years ago, we began to believe that if we say the right words, the right number of times, the right moment that we've said the prayer, and while there may be prayers that work well this way, we also know that there are modalities of prayer that are beyond the words. They're based in the power of human feeling that we lost 1,700 years ago. We asked him about his libraries. He said, do you have ancient records, ancient texts that we could look at? And to make a long story very brief, he said yes, and he was happy to show them to us because of a friendship and a camaraderie that had developed. We were led down a series of hallways with 30-foot-tall Buddhas of compassion on either side into a darkened room, and all we could see was through the flicker of yak butter candles. And we began to see row after row after row of text after text after text, and we opened them to the translator. I said, ask him what's in these texts. And he said, everything. And I said, what do you mean, everything? And he said, we have a record of every spiritual tradition that has ever come to this place, and we keep them here. And he said, in many cases, we live them right now. It's very possible that what we see these Tibetan monks doing is actually stemming from the remnants at the basis of our own spiritual beliefs and traditions that were lost, and they have them where we had forgotten. The key is that feeling is the prayer. What we know is that prayer researchers today identify four modes of prayer. We call them informal or colloquial prayer, petitionary prayer, ritualistic prayer, and some forms of meditative prayer. And prayer is a very personal word, and it may not be the best word to use to describe what's happening here. And as good as all of these are, what we know is that there is an inner technology that may not fit into these categories, that there is a fifth mode of feeling-based prayer. And I'm going to share this with you now, and then I'd like for you to witness. And if you cannot see this video, I will narrate what is about to happen on the video. It's a prayer that's based in feeling as if the prayer were already answered, rather than asking through the thoughts that the answer come to pass. Feeling the feeling as if the prayer has already been answered. The Essene Gospel of Peace, one of the texts that was edited, reminds us, when our thoughts, body, and feeling become one, then you say to the mountain, mountain, move. And the mountain moves. And this may begin to understand, help us understand what this is all about. I'd like to share a brief story to help illustrate this concept, because stories are powerful. In the early 1990s, I was living in northern New Mexico, and a Native American friend of mine invited me to join him for a prayer of rain. That's going to be important in just a moment. During one of the worst droughts in the history of the American desert Southwest. I went with my friend. We met at a predetermined location. We went across several hundred thousand acres of very fragrant high desert sage, and we came to a place that was so ancient, even his ancestors didn't know who put this place here. And here's the key. He said, this place is where the skin between the worlds is very thin. The many possibilities. I was not prepared. I had an expectation of what I thought would happen. I wasn't prepared for what I saw. My friend removed his Kmart work boots, stepped barefooted into this circle. He honored all of his ancestors, all of those who had come before him. He closed his eyes, placed a prayer mudra in front of his chest, and in just a couple of moments, he looked at his watch and he said, I'm hungry. You want me to get a bite to eat? And I said, I thought we came here to pray for rain. And he said, no. He said, if we prayed for rain, rain could never happen. Because the moment you pray for something to happen, what have you just said? It's not here now. Essentially, you're acknowledging, when you say, dear God, please let there be peace in the world, a very well-intentioned prayer, you may in fact be saying there is no peace here now. And I said, what did you do when I saw you close your eyes? And this is the way he described it to me. He said, when I closed my eyes, he said, I felt the feeling of mud moving between my naked toes, the mud from our Pueblo village that is so plentiful because there's been that much rain. And I smelled the smell of what it smells like when the rain bounces off the earthen walls of our Pueblo village. And I felt the feeling of what it feels like to run naked through chest-high fields of corn. The corn is so plentiful because there's been that much rain. And in that moment, my prayer became a prayer of thanks, gratitude, and appreciation. And I said, do you mean thanks for what you created? And he said, no, we never create anything. So there it is. He said, we never create anything. He said, my thanks is for the opportunity to choose which creation I experience. That is an example of a feeling-based prayer, our lost mode of prayer. The ancient Essenes invite us to redefine what we experience outside of our bodies by addressing what we've become from within. To change our conditions of war, oppression, mass suffering, we're invited to change the way we feel. When we impose change on our world, when our military, bless their hearts, our military does such a powerful job, when our medical profession, bless their hearts, they do such a powerful job, when they impose a change upon our physical world, have they changed the blueprint that allowed that physical world to be what it is in the first place? What they do is they buy us time. They buy us a window of time. Whether or not we have the wisdom to know how to use that time is what we're finding now. Is the new diseases come back with a vengeance we thought we cured in the 60s, in the 50s. And the little strife and areas of civil war spring up all over the world, places where we thought the peace was there. We bought ourselves relative time out there. We imposed change there, giving us time to become the change from within, because the world out there mirrors what we are from within. This is precisely what the ancients are saying to us about our world of feeling. What I'd like to do is, I have a rare video clip. I'd like to set it up for you and share it with you. Now, this is co-creation in action, because when we left, it was out and it's been plugged in. And my prayer, I'm feeling the feeling of what it feels like to have it cued peacefully and perfectly at the right place. So before we show that, let me share with you what it is that you're about to see, because it's an example of precisely, and we'll be ready in just a minute. This is a rare piece of video footage. It was taken in a medicineless hospital in Beijing, China. A medicineless hospital. You're going to see a woman who is fully awake. She is under no anesthetic. We get to see an ultrasound inside of her body, in the presence of three practitioners who are having a feeling. Now, we can call that prayer, or we can call it an inner technology, we can call it a belief system, you can call it whatever you'd like, because those are only words. The point is, and the reason I'm sharing this video with you, is because we have all heard so much for years about this relationship between mind and matter, or spirit and matter, or feeling and matter, and I know we believe it. However, when we see it, it catapults us into a new level of belief, because once you see, you cannot unsee. So one of two things happens. You either say, well, that's a trick because you can do anything on computers today, or you say, I've just seen something that validates a belief that I have from within. So what you're going to see is the woman has been diagnosed with a potentially life-threatening cancer in her bladder, 3 inches in diameter. Through the ultrasound, we'll look at that cancer on the left-hand side of the screen, and then we'll freeze it for reference, okay? Freeze frame. On the right side, we're going to see real time. This is not time lapse. In less than 3 minutes, what you will see is the cancer disappears in the presence of three practitioners who are feeling the feeling of what it is like to be in the presence of a woman who is vital, healthy, fully capacitated, fully enabled. They have not judged the cancer as right, wrong, good, or bad. They said, yes, cancer is a possibility. And there are other quantum possibilities. To awaken that healed state, we will have the feeling of what it feels like, and this world then will mirror that. Does that make sense? Are you okay with that? Because this is so exhilarating, and I'm so honored to be able to share this with you tonight. So we're not finished yet. Thank you. So if you would be so kind as to bring our sound down so that I may narrate over this. Here's a woman lying prone. There is a practitioner, a technician, using an ultrasound over her lower abdomen. Three practitioners who are trained in what we would call emotional self-management. They understand how to hold these emotions, how to hold these feelings. This is the ultrasound. The blackness that you see, and if this is on tape, you can see it in the screen of your mind's eye. The void is inside the bladder. The emptiness and there is a white lump, the 3-inch diameter cancer. This is the part that is threatening her life. This is freeze-framed. Now, this is real time, right here. And the three practitioners are saying a word that there's no magic in the word. If you'll bring the sound up a little. Do we have sound, by the way? They're saying a word. There's no magic in this word. It could be any word. This word reinforces the feeling within them. So please don't ask me what the magic word is. Any word that reinforces the feeling. Watch what happens here. 2 minutes and 40 seconds is how long it takes. Two minutes and 40 seconds. What you're seeing is that the cancer is no longer visible. The bladder appears healthy. It looks vital. Now I'm going to let this run just for a moment so that you can see what happens next. Because the practitioners will simply politely bow, clap their hands, because to them this is no miracle. They understand a relationship that we're just beginning to understand. Okay, can you stop that, please? Thank you. How do you feel when you see something like that? Do you believe it? This is simply an example, and the only reason that I'm sharing this with you is that so we may, in this brief period of time, catapult ourselves into the place where we say tonight, if we've never seen it before, we've seen this relationship between a non-physical force, whatever you'd like to call it, and the physical world through a medium that our science today is just beginning to understand in the West. On the other hand, ancient and indigenous traditions for at least 6,000 years have allowed for this possibility, and it is that view that allows them to hold and honor their teachings in the way they do. This is the power. If this can happen for one person in 2 minutes and 40 seconds, and we have case histories of many people using this technique coordinated by the World Wide Web, we can teach this modality of prayer, this kind of feeling on the World Wide Web, using this in 85 nations where several hundred people are feeling the feeling of peace in our world. U.S. warplanes turn around in midair on their way to Baghdad for bombing runs. Peace treaties between in Belfast, Northern Ireland, signed 3 days early in the presence of what researchers call the prayer window. This is the inner technology that gives me the confidence to say to you that I know there's a power that lives within us that allows us to heal our bodies, bring a lasting peace to this earth that we love so dearly, and to perhaps avert the greatest tragedies ever to face humankind. As we feel the feelings, we awaken the possibilities that are already created, we invite them. We invite them rather than imposing them to become the overlay that we experience each time we do that. Now we're calling that the Isaiah effect. This is what our book is all about and much more. So I believe that I've probably gone to the limit of time and laid the foundation so that Deepak and I may have a dialogue. I'd like to say thank you for your patience. Very, very quick. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. That was absolutely fantastic. And you came at a very synchronistic moment, right? Because everyone in this room was totally prepared to listen to you. And you came just at the right moment, just at the right moment. So the first thing that they heard in the beginning of this course was from David, when he said, in the subatomic world, there are no objects, only oscillating possibilities. Only oscillating possibilities. And these are superpositions of possibilities. So they all simultaneously exist. They all simultaneously exist. And this is what you have been really reinforcing And this is what we've been practicing the last few days. For example, one of the sutras today was, when we are perfectly established in peace, then all beings around us cease to feel hostility, which is a Vedic sutra. It says, when we are totally established in peace, then all beings around us cease to feel hostility. And I think the fatal flaw of science has been that science has separated the observer from the observed. And I think I may have quoted this Rumi poem the other day. I have lived on the lip of insanity, wanting to know reasons, knocking at the door opens, I've been knocking from the inside. Okay? Because there's no way we can separate ourselves from nature, because we are nature. And our brains and our nervous system is recycled dust. And so if there's turbulence in our consciousness, naturally, that reflects in the turbulence in the environment, because the environment is not the environment, it's our extended body. If our physical body trembles, then our extended body also trembles. And we know also from animals, you know, animals can sense earthquakes before they happen, or a hurricane, or a storm, or many things that are happening, because we are inseparably, our physical bodies, our minds are inseparably part of the pattern of intelligence, energy, and information that permeates the cosmos. And here, just look at, you know, it's kind of re-saying what you said a few minutes ago. The ability to see several event lines simultaneously and predict the future based on choices in the moment. Isn't that something?
That's exactly. So what this says is we've all done our work very well together.
Synchronistically speaking, a shift in cognitive and perceptual mechanisms, because the world is a projection of our cognition and perceptual mechanisms, awakening of dormant potentialities and the wisdom to use them. These in Sanskrit are called siddhis, superhuman abilities in the material world. So, you know, the ability to predict event lines, prophecy, clairvoyance, clairaudience, remembrance of former lifetimes, synchronicity, mathematical genius, musical genius, child prodigies have these shifts in cognitive and perceptual mechanisms that give them superhuman abilities in the material world. And then riddhis, which are, you know, control over elements of nature and events. So this is, in fact, what you're calling the Isaiah effect. Mm-hmm. And the sutra practices is that practice that establishes that continuity between the world of pure consciousness on the one hand, the physical body and the material world, and then the quantum domain that intervenes. So thank you so much for coming and reinforcing what they know.
Thank you.
This has been a Hay House audio production. If you would like a free catalog of books and videos offered by Hay House, please call us at 1-800-654-5126 or visit www.hayhouse.com.